You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon, I'm Louis Sines, your host for Perspectives, and joining us today is Dr. Gregory Rocha from the Political Science Department. Dr. Rocha, of course, is no stranger to KTEP, has been our political expert and helped us out on various issues. And today we're going to talk a little bit about President Obama's second term and what to expect, and talk a little bit about second term presidents. Greg, thank you very much for being with us here today.
And thank you, Louis.
Now, Greg, as I mentioned, talking a little bit about second-term presidents, and of course, there have been other presidents, FDR, of course, who served more. But let's talk a little bit about going back in history to the first president and George Washington and when the founding fathers set that all in place. Initially, there was a lot of debate, correct, about what kind of leader they wanted, because some people wanted to get away from the monarchy and some people wanted that kind of leadership. So they didn't know what to call the leader and how to sort of what kind of leadership he should have.
Right. And so much of that was put into the hands of Washington. And he pretty much did that by example. And he would do this and so on and so forth. And along the way, sort of created the template for what we think of when we see the modern presidents today. And there was always this reference back to what is it that the first president did. And I think, Louis, that in great part helps us understand why is it that Washington so admired, that what he did, again, was a pretty good job of laying down the basis for what we expect presidents to do. And while, of course, it evolves, and surely the president today is quite a bit different from presidents of an earlier time, nonetheless, we have in Washington the person who really cast the mold for what we see with presidents today.
Now, he stepped down after two terms, and he said that he was going to finish. Is he the one who set the precedent for that?
Absolutely. And so it might have been that other presidents could have served more terms, but it really wasn't until Roosevelt and the circumstances of Franklin Roosevelt's time with the Depression and war that we saw the presidency extend onward. And then, of course, afterward, the amendment was added to the Constitution to set the term limits for a president at 2 4-year terms.
Of course, as you mentioned, President Washington really didn't know what to expect as being the first president, and he did set the precedent. But other presidents also all of a sudden were faced with situations that had never happened before. For example, President Lincoln with the secession of the states and the Civil War, and then President Bush with 9/11, the Depression, World War II, and then, of course, probably one of the toughest decisions that I would think would be President Truman with the bomb.
Oh, absolutely. And when we consider how it is that presidents have had to react to these crises, not only does it perhaps establish a precedent for what other presidents might do, but sometimes it defines one's presidency. And it, as we've heard, the great presidents are those who somehow manage this nation and get it through the worst of crises, whether, again, as you mentioned, the wars and their effect. And so we've seen that. But then also we've seen other things grow out of crises and conditions, whether it's the rise of something like the Federal Reserve, which has such a strong effect on monetary policy and the overall economy. Again, that grew out of economic conditions of an earlier time and the effort to try to smooth out the economy so that we wouldn't go through those ups and downs. So a lot of things happen, and much of it, as you said, Louis, kind of goes back to what it is the presidents do and how they try to respond to those times.
What about when all of a sudden you are put into that situation, for example, President Truman or President Johnson, President Roosevelt, because of assassination? What happens?
Oh, it is so tough, Louis. And surely that individual has to make those tough decisions. But it's also very important to remember that there are people around that person, that president, who he depends on for advice and counsel and support. And so we often see the people who are very close to the president are the closest of advisors and almost the closest of friends. And surely we saw that perhaps carried out to the fullest extent in the Kennedy presidency with his brother Robert serving as Attorney General. And I think it's well known that the story was told of how his father told John upon taking office that under the worst of crises, under the worst of situations anyone could face, no one could be trusted more than one's brother or one's family member. And Robert surely helped him through some of the most difficult of crises we've seen a president go through.
As far as President Obama goes, you know, people were wondering, and perhaps why was he sworn in on Martin Luther King Day? Because traditionally the Constitution says that the president's term expires on the 20th at noon. This is a situation that happened also to President, I believe, Eisenhower and Reagan.
That may well have been. And of course, we know that the president formally, in order to meet the constitutional mandate, was sworn in a ceremony on Sunday. But, you know, this being the presidency what it is today, Louis, and speaking of our evolution of the office, there's also quite a bit of ceremony that is attached to it. And you could see we really didn't need that inauguration on Monday in order to satisfy legal requirements. But there's more to the presidency than just what's in the law. There's this other aura that's associated with the office, and I think that's why we saw that ceremony on Tuesday and all the things that we've seen in the past.
Now, the President Obama, obviously, when he was running for re-election, he had a plate full already, and so he gets re-elected. His plate is full and perhaps even fuller now. But now people expect him to do things that perhaps he didn't do his first term. And then some people are saying, well, he's a lame duck president, so there's not much that he can do.
Right. Louis, that again speaks to what happens when we set term limits on somebody and they get past that threshold and they know that there's no longer, you know, another election that the president will have to go through. And we've seen fairly recently a number of presidents try to get through that second term. And it's not as easy as the first. Perhaps they lose some steam. Perhaps they lose some support, or they get set off for any number of different reasons, whether it's President Clinton and Monica Lewinsky or Iran-Contra and President Reagan. But lately, it has been pretty tough for a president to be as successful in their second term as they've been with their first.
As far as President Obama, in your opinion, as a political analyst and scholar, what are some of the things that he will have to address during the second term?
Well, yeah, clearly the big one without any question whatsoever is the economy. And here he finds himself struggling with the conditions of today, polarized political party system, and fighting with the Republicans, even trying to manage his coalition of Democrats there, and how they address the economy and the things that they've done with the stages that have been taken to try to address this makes that quite a bit of a problem for him. And perhaps it is that it'll be one of the things that defines how he does that. And I think that's part of the kind of concern he absolutely has to address. And then there are others, such as immigration, which is pretty important. Well, but that has I think, unlike the economy, has more of a overt political tone to it, in the sense that he understood that one of the reasons that he got elected was because of the support of Latinos or Asian Americans or others who have pushed strongly for immigration reform, and he has to respond to the interests of his coalition there. So we surely have that. And who knows, Louis, there may be threats coming from other parts of the world that we don't know about. We heard earlier this week of how it is that Senator Clinton said that it's important for the United States to remain engaged on the global stage, particularly in the Middle East and especially now the growing concern in Africa. We shouldn't be surprised, for instance, to see what will come up before the president and, you know, on the global stage. So there's that, health care. I mean, there's so many other things. That's health care, you know, in its continued evolution, that all of which has to be managed.
One of the things that has popped up recently, and tragically, you know, we had an incident in Albuquerque last weekend with gun control.
Yeah, and you know, he's laid down his marker, and I think he's having won that president, you know, his second term, and I think himself, you know, believing that something needs to be done to try to get a handle on this issue, has taken a position, I think, that pretty much in the center of what it is that the Democratic Party would like to see. But he has his hands full. The NRA is very well organized, and they've been that way for quite some time. And the core support within that group is as strong and as fervent as any interest group that's out there in the United States. And I think it's fairly safe to say they're probably the most effective interest group working in the United States and surely in Washington right now. So the president has his hands full. And already you can see it, you know, I think that momentum that he had to try to bring about some change is starting to slow down a little bit. And it's crucial to act now because the longer it goes, the more that works, I think, to the benefit of, you know, the NRA and others who take the position they've had on the Second Amendment.
We have seen a few changes already, but do you expect immediate changes in the cabinet?
Probably so. And again, we're kind of getting back to look at the presidency and the office. 4 years in that, even in a cabinet position, can be pretty grueling. And we think of, and we've seen how it is that a president goes in looking young and they leave looking fairly old. We may not see that so much with cabinet secretaries, but they oversee huge agencies. And it is demanding, even if they aren't in the news. And so often, to no great surprise, we've seen this fairly recently with various presidencies that a number of people decide, you know, I've done all I possibly can or perhaps want to, and it's time for me to get back to a normal life. And think of how many times we've heard cabinet secretaries say that they do want to spend more time with their families and doing things, and that's perfectly understandable. It's, as we've heard, 25 hours a day, 8 days a week for them when they get on there, and they understand that.
And you see a big turnover also, as you mentioned before in another interview, with press secretaries.
Oh, absolutely. And now, with the rise of the modern media as we see it today, they're in as much of the pressure cooker as anybody else is, because it's their duty and responsibility to try to offer some kind of public explanation for things the administration does.
One of the things that we sort of talked about last fall was the fact about the fact that both countries, Mexico and us, were getting new presidents. So tell us a little bit about what role do you expect or do you think President Obama is going to have to play with the new president of Mexico, because the president in Mexico, Peña Nieto, is going to be, this is new to him as well.
Oh, absolutely. And we've already seen, Louis, the symbolic tradition that started with President George W. Bush, of the Mexican president coming to the United States after having won the election and so forth. That, again, is a tradition that we've seen here. And so, again, Mr. Peña Nieto's already been here and carried on that. And we've, have to learn how to better manage that relationship. And I think President Obama probably sees opportunities to make some change and to make things better for the two countries, and especially with the Mexican economy growing as it is. It's managed itself much better over the past few years than has we've seen in the United States. They haven't had the overall conditions confront them the way that we have. So there's that. There are opportunities, and we know that well living here on the border with Juarez and Chihuahua and Mexico, of course. So there's that. And then also with Mr. Peña Nieto taking a different approach toward the management of the drug cartels, I think there's a rethinking of how do we set up our relationship with this new way of trying to manage that. Again, there was strong support for the past administration's efforts to really go after these cartels. But as Peña Nieto said, that made us worse off. We lost so many people that we really haven't gotten any far. We're going to try something different. We'll have to see how that all plays out.
Former President Calderon, there was a lot of criticism also about him teaching at Harvard.
Yeah. Well, that's always been one of the traditions. The past president leaves the country, I think, in a sense of trying to give space to that new administration and what they want to do. So it's not necessarily in the tradition, or I should say anything different from what we've seen past presidents do, and that is leaving the country. And we've seen other Mexican presidents at institutions. Mr. Zedillo, I believe when he finished up his presidency, went to Yale for a while. I believe now he's with the World Bank.
Carlos Salinas also went
to Ireland or whatever, and De La Madrid also left. So there is that, and that criticism, I'm sure there, you know, anybody who's in an executive position finds criticism. You can't please everyone, as presidents know.
As you mentioned, it's hard to please people, and the fact that Hispanics, Latinos did go out and help reelect President Obama, because they wanted immigration reform. How much time does he have as far as getting to work on that before he starts hearing the cries of, you said you were going to do something about this?
Louis, I think he heard that from Latinos even before he got reelected, or at least during the campaign. And so it is, there were times when all of a sudden he said, well, we're going to stop this particular policy and begin another, again, rounding up people or arresting people and sending them away, he announced during one of his campaign efforts. So that has gone on. But I think he's got a pretty short time within which to do this, particularly before the election in what it would be 2014. But at the same time, I think Republicans have calculated that the positions they've taken on immigration haven't worked to their best interests. And there are those within the GOP, people like Senator Rubio, Jeb Bush, who are trying to make the case within the party that some sort of immigration reform needs to be taken, both in terms of policy and to smooth things out in terms of people becoming either legal residents or citizens, but then also politically, Louis. It's the Republicans right now are doing some pretty deep soul-searching about how do they maintain themselves as a strong political party here.
Some people have talked about that in the past, like when we heard about the Dixiecrats and, of course, and the Democrats, and the fact that the Republican Party has to do something to make themselves look like they are not the party of the elite or the extreme conservative. And, of course, you know, we've seen this throughout history. It's been a long time, but I remember when you talk to our founding fathers, there were a lot of parties that the change of, from the Federalists, the Whigs, the wannabes and all that stuff. In fact, some of them sounded like names that we used to use when we were playing intramural sports or something.
Oh, yeah. And Louis, we don't really have to go that far back to see the Democrats and the difficulty
they
faced.
Right.
That
mm-hmm.
was just maybe about 20, maybe 30 years ago. When President Reagan came into office, he just really allowed the or did enough to get the Republican Party to expand dramatically. And as the Democrats continued to move or drift more and more leftward, it took people more centrists, people like Bill Clinton and the Democratic leadership, to kind of come in and take a more centrist position and move the party back to the middle. Again, you know, political parties do drift, and there are times when they have to rethink, how do we get back that strong base of supporters to us? And that's what the Republicans are doing now. They're where the Democrats might have been maybe about 25 or 30 years ago.
As you mentioned, the technology has changed so much where information can be. In fact, when Osama bin Laden was shot, somebody used Twitter to let people know that a U.S. Helicopter was in the area. So you can't take steps or do anything without somebody knowing about it, and sometimes even before the real press or the real media, the professionals get it, you know. It could be an amateur who shoots something and all of a sudden it's out on the web or whatever, and people realize that. So that brings us back to also what the president has talked about time and time again, also Homeland Security, terrorism, and also Afghanistan.
Right. And it's how do you manage all of this, particularly at a time when there's so much information out there and it's not any longer just I'll read the newspaper tomorrow or watch a news program a few hours away to try to get this information. It's there and it's available almost immediately. And it may not go through the filter of a news organization, but somebody can do something with it and send it out so that other people take a look at what's done. And all of a sudden you have a unique side or a distinct explanation for something that nobody really has control over. And, you know, kind of getting back to what we said before, Louis, about press secretaries, the responsibility that's put onto them. I mean, imagine how hard it is to try to manage news coming out when you have little of any control over anything. I think, you know, most press secretaries would probably tell you they have very little control over things. Well, now they have absolutely no control.
You get burned out so fast, too. Anything.
Sure. Oh, the challenge is just as daunting as it is for anyone.
And because of what's changed, as you mentioned earlier, Monica Lewinsky, you know, it used to be almost like a rule that the press didn't cover certain things or talk about certain things. But I think it might have opened up too when Senator Hart said, follow me.
Yeah.
And they did.
Right. And again, Lou, you and I have talked about how it is that there was a concerted effort to make sure that the public rarely saw President Roosevelt, you know, in his braces. So that's out the door. In fact, if anything, we have people looking to see how can we get things about presidents and others that wasn't such a problem that long ago.
In fact, it was, I think, it hasn't been until recently that Dalek wrote the book on Kennedy that his medical records were released because they tried to keep it secret, you know, that he had the back brace, that he had to use crutches, mm-hmm. and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. And there are more things, Louis, that are coming out. So that's, you know, hardly the latest or the only thing that's going to come out here.
As far as the president goes and the fact that he is a lame duck president, is that something that some people are going to say, well, that's going to hurt him because Congress will take advantage of that. But at the same time, I can't imagine that any president would go in there and say, well, it doesn't really matter because I'm almost finished. Because they want to do the best job that they can and
right,
be remembered.
But I also think, Louis, getting reelected is liberating in its own way. And I'm sure the president thinks, well, I don't have to go through the process of reelection again. And if I can just keep things moving, and if I can get some momentum going here, then I can do what I want. I don't have to worry about so much about organizing for another reelection. I can really focus on the things that I want to. And I think we sort of saw that in a way in this inaugural address when he, I think probably spoke from the heart more than he had up to that time. And that wasn't something that necessarily pleased the Republicans. But again, I think it was a fairly liberating moment for Barack Obama.
I'm glad that you brought that up, the inaugural address, because that is something that is very important because later on in years, and historians will look at the inaugural address and they'll say, this is what President so-and-so said this. And, of course, people remember President Lincoln's second inaugural address very much. And, of course, that's the one where John Wilkes Booth said, this is it, where he thought, I'm going to do this. How will people remember President Obama from what you've seen so far? I mean, it's hard to predict, I know, but every president kind of sets his own agenda, sets their own stage. Has President Obama become a different kind of president than other presidents, his style?
Surely. And I guess there's always this distinctiveness to any president when somebody looks that closely. But I imagine that his legacy is going to be built on health care, and that here was the president who was able to get it passed. Now, whether that's good or bad, you know, again, history will probably tell us. But given, again, what had other presidents had tried to do to get that passed, but here was somebody who was able to do so, I assume that first paragraph about him and his legacy, for better or worse, will be he was the president who got health care through the Congress and put it into law.
When he was first elected, whether you voted for him or not, a lot of people have told me that when they watched that inauguration, they felt very emotional, mm-hmm. because he was the first African-American president to be elected, and the fact that it showed that here in the United States that could be done.
Mm-hmm. And I think in part we could see that again, that this wasn't a fluke and that he got again reelected. And we've, you know, perhaps crossed a big Rubicon. There's still a lot left to do. But again, it shows that there are things going on in the United States we may not see in other parts of the world, and that we can point to certain things that we do that we're, you know, able to do and do so proudly, I think.
He has talked about in Afghanistan perhaps cleaning up and it being a supervision kind of mission in a couple of years or maybe a year. What about the military as far as bases being affected and Fort Bliss being affected? Because a lot of times people have said that when a Democratic administration is in office, defense budget is cut.
Louis, I think we'll just have to see what happens as this new set of conditions in the president and the Congress try to work out some way to work up a budget and then also try to draw down or reduce the growth of the debt. And right now it looks like the Republicans are surely focusing on things like social services, Medicare, Medicaid, and so forth, and that definitely needs to be attended to. But it looks also, though, like there are Republicans, many of them in the House, who also want to take a pretty close look at defense to see what's going to happen here. And if something doesn't happen in this, then and the law goes into effect, then there will be some pretty sharp cuts in defense. And I'm not sure we want that particularly now.
Greg, thank you very much for being with us here today. We've been visiting with Dr. Gregory Rocha from the Political Science Department, talking a little bit about President Obama's second term and what he has to face, and also a little bit of his history of past presidents and past inaugurations.
This is Primetime Postscript. I'm Mike Cuthbert. Playing in the ocean is something many people take for granted, but for some, it's a worthwhile experience that requires a little helping hand. Dave Grunbaum went to Long Branch, New Jersey to observe the Best Day at the Beach program, which makes it possible for developmentally and physically challenged kids to ride the waves.
Hey, Austin, you ready to go surfing?
Austin Bramson is about to surf for the first time, and that will be quite an accomplishment. Austin is 15 years old and has a rare genetic disorder called Phelan-McDermid syndrome. Austin's mother, Nancy, explains some of the challenges he faces.
He needs to be fed. He cannot self-feed at all. He cannot self-drink. He cannot dress himself. He's in a wheelchair, which he cannot operate himself.
Austin cannot speak or even walk. But now he's getting ready to ride the waves of the Atlantic. Volunteers put their arms around Austin's body.
Under the armpit. Under his arm. We got him.
Lift him out of his wheelchair and put him on his stomach on the top of a surfboard.
Austin, you look fired up, buddy. You look really fired up.
Austin is wearing a life jacket and water safety helmet. The volunteers carry him out into the ocean about 50 feet from the shore, and when the right wave comes, Austin starts riding it with the help of one volunteer who's lying on the back of the surfboard.
Woo! Woo! Good job, Austin.
There's a wide grin on Austin's face as he comes ashore. His arms and legs wiggle with excitement. His mother, Nancy, is beaming.
It just had to be pure joy. Just had to be pure joy. The smile on his face. I haven't seen that smile in a long time from him. So, I mean, I started to cry. You wonder sometimes when you have a child with a disability, are they happy? And to see that, I knew he was happy. At that moment, he was happy.
Austin is enjoying an event called Best Day at the Beach. Here, developmentally and physically challenged kids and young adults ages 4 to 24 get help surfing, boogie boarding, and kayaking to the cheers of their families and teams of volunteers. Max Montgomery, who's been surfing for more than 3 decades, co-founded Best Day at the Beach 4 years ago in his native California after being inspired by a similar local program.
Jump right back on the board, we'll take it right up.
12-year-old Jenny Heath Kaplan is autistic. But here she is, back on a surfboard, just like her first trip to Best Day at the Beach last year.
Awesome, dude!
Her mother, Wendy, says the fun and social interaction helps Jenny progress.
Well, oftentimes we find that when we give her an experience like this, she gets a language surge. So she'll, on the way home, say things that we've never heard her say before. And so I think that thrill translates into that sort of surge.
What kind of things does she say?
She might say something like, the water was very cold today or something. Just lovely formed sentences that we've never heard from her before.
And on this day, each time Jenny finishes riding a wave to the shore, she asks for another trip.
Let's go again!
Let's go again! Let's go again! Run it back!
For AARP Radio, this is Dave Grunebaum.
This has been Primetime Postscript, made possible by AARP, and today, Dave Grunbaum.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.